San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
All right, good evening, everybody. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you from KFMB Studios with 50,000 watts of power. We're heard not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, LA County, up the coast of Seattle, down to Cabo, out to the desert. And if you download the app for 760 KFMB, you can hear us on your smartphone, or we stream live on 760KFMB.com, and all the podcasts are at iymoney.com. And now time to introduce the main man of the hour. He's a CPA extraordinaire. He's a family office expert advising several high-net-worth families. He's a best-selling author and an accomplished marathon runner and a lot of other things. But good evening, Richard. How are you tonight?
I am marvelous, Joe. I'm sprinting out of here after we're done tonight to go to the Tri-City Hospital Foundation Gala, because they're one of the big sponsors of my Oceanside Turkey Trot.
There you go. So
fun stuff.
OceanSideTurkeyTrot.com, which
it.
Is coming
we're
up.
We're going to see you out there this year.
You are going to see me. I don't know how far I'm going to run, but I'll bring a sweet potato and do what I can. But
stop halfway and get a cappuccino.
Anyway, we've got two great guests tonight. Yeah. The second guest is a journalist from the UT San Diego, Gary Robbins. We'll get to him in a little while. But on the line, we have a very accomplished professor of political science from UC San Diego, and his name is Thad Couser. Thad, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
That's wonderful. Hey, I know that you, you teach about, three courses at UCSD, correct?
At least.
But you do a lot of consulting, a lot of traveling, and I think you were just in Paris giving a talk about the election results. So can you tell us, what was that conference about, and maybe we can start going over some of your findings.
Right. Well, the whole world was watching last week as America turned right and elected a Republican Congress. So there are actually a lot of French scholars that study California politics and American politics in general. So we're at Sciences Po, which is the big fancy French political science institute. And there were French scholars, American scholars. I was there, a guy from Columbia University, and then a whole lot of American expatriates in the audience, as well as French residents who care about America.
So were these mostly academics, or were they people in politics per se, and lobbyists, or was it a mix of everything?
It was a mix. It was a lot of academics and students in the morning, and then in the evening there was actually the showing of a film about Governor Pat Brown, California's governor, made by his granddaughters, and that brought out a couple hundred folks who were a lot of them the Democrats abroad. You know, people organized for the Democratic Party live abroad, and they needed something to shake them out of their depression last week.
But why the fascination with California?
Because I think a lot of people think that this is where California's diversity and all of the interesting politics that comes from that, that's where France is headed. So France is getting more diverse. They've had some riots, just as California's had in the 90s and in the 60s, and so they look to California as a hint towards their future.
Well, we're about ready to burn down the Bastille over here, so what the heck. But hey, how was that documentary, by the way? Was it pretty good?
Show. It's what, California State of Mind, and it really, it has, lots of governors, Tom Brokaw, just an amazing group of people giving their thoughts, and then a lot of video that transports you back into the 1960s when California was built. We built water projects. We built UC campuses, including UCSD.
What do you say we track that down and maybe show it on campus or somewhere? I think that might be
great.
All right, we'll talk about that. But anyway, let's go over some of the results here. I went through your slides, and it was titled, "Was it a tsunami or a ripple?" And what's your take?
Well, I think obviously this was a big Republican surge across the country. We saw it most obviously in the retaking of the Senate seats. But again, that was really no surprise, right? We knew all the models were predicting that, because the Democrats were trying to contest all these really red states, very Republican-leaning states, strongly, homogeneously white states without a lot of the recent immigrant voters, Latinos, Asian Americans, and African Americans, who have been such an important part of the Democratic Obama coalition. You didn't have those in Montana, South Dakota, so it was no surprise that Republicans won there. the two big surprises were how well Republicans did in state houses. They took, you know, many of these governor's races in blue states like Massachusetts and Maryland. They captured more state houses than they've had in almost 100 years, state legislatures.
Mm-hmm.
And the other big surprise was at the same time that that people were electing all these Tea Party folks. So in Nebraska, you know, a Tea Party candidate won the Senate race by 27 points, and the state enacted a minimum wage law, one of four states to raise their minimum wage.
Yeah, there was a lot of things that were incongruous, weren't there? I mean,
yeah, you know, Alaska, Oregon, and the District of Columbia make marijuana legal. California really reduces sentences for people convicted of drug and property crimes. So there, on all of the initiatives, there is this leftward turn at the same time that for candidate races, we're taking a rightward turn.
Mm.
It's because of the economy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in my humble opinion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, Richard and I both have wanted to ask about the turnout. I mean, it was abysmally low. But compared to other midterm elections, was this pretty typical or was this lower than usual?
Yeah, this was bad, right? So midterm elections, without the presidency up for grabs, turnout's always low. But this was lower in just about every state than we normally see. And California, you know, we don't have the full numbers until all the mail ballots are counted. But we may set the low the record for the lowest turnout in history for one of these midterm generals. Just as in June, we set the record for the lowest turnout in the history of a primary election in California, with only about 25% of voters turning out.
But can I ask a philosophical question? Because you alluded to this when you said that France is getting more diverse. I would argue that the voter turnout in California is not representative of the demographics of California. That is to say, only certain demographics vote. Am I right or wrong?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Right, if you look at California as a whole, we're a state that's now slightly more Latino than white, but our electorate is about, depending on the election, between 70-75% white.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes down as low as 65%, but it's still very strongly white electorate. And you saw that nationally, right? Where our electorate across the country is about 75% white, and that's not representative of where we are demographically yet.
And is that indicative of people feeling not included or disenfranchised? I mean, what is inherently behind that?
Well, part of that is what you have to do to be eligible to vote isn't equally distributed across ethnic groups. So Latinos and Asian Americans, much younger populations, so you don't have as many people over 18. Lots more people who are immigrants, either legal or here without documentation, here illegally. Either way, you're not voting until you become a naturalized citizen. And so with these newer populations, it takes a while to become politically incorporated. And that leads to these feelings of not being included, not being part of the electorate electing the lawmakers making really important decisions for everyone, whether they're a voter or not.
So is language a barrier too?
You know, our registrars have to do a great job of providing election information in San Diego. They're doing it not only in Spanish, but in Tagalog and in Korean and Mandarin and in lots of languages. But still, if you're watching an ethnic language media, maybe that media, you know, you aren't seeing as many ads, right?
Sure.
You're not inundated with Carl DeMaio, Scott Peters ads, right?
Right.
Maybe that's an advantage. But you're going to be less attuned to what's going on in the election.
Are we seeing the result of the Citizens United with all these additional ads now? Have they loosened all this dark money? I mean, they don't even know where the money's coming from anymore. Is that, and you're seeing, a plethora of more ads. Are we going to get more of that in 2016?
Well, we've certainly seen a lot of money. So this election, $3.7 billion, almost as much as a presidential election, right? And a ton of that money was focused on just a few handful of swing districts like the 52nd Congressional District, Scott Peters and Carl DeMaio here, or the swing Senate states. So a ton of ads in these places. It's not all due to Citizens United. That gets sort of the root of all evil for many political reformers. But it's partly that just the stakes of American elections are so high that there's going to be a lot of money, and then there are a lot of that money came not indirectly through through these shadow organizations that Citizens United allows, but directly to candidates from voters and from interest groups who just see a lot of a lot at stake when the Senate is up for grabs.
Mm. Well, Thad, we have to take a break right there, but we have to have you come back on, and we'll do a more extensive show because I only got about half of my questions. But thank you so much for being our guest, and we'll be in touch. Okay.
Great. Thanks for having me.
All right,
thanks,
pleasure.
Dad.
Anyway, we got to take a little break right now. I'll come right back with Gary Robbins of the UT San Diego right after this. Hang on.
AM 760 KFMB. AM 760 KFMB.
All right, we're back with the award-winning It's Your Money and Your Life. And I'm Joe Vecchio, my co-host Richard Musio, and our special guest is a bona fide journalist who's been in the business many, many years. His name is Gary Robbins from the UT San Diego. Gary, good evening. How are you?
I'm fine. Gunsmoke? I love that.
Yeah, we've got to get his microphone on first. All right. How are you, Gary?
I'm doing great.
Good, good, good. The reason we invited you on was I attended that wonderful screening of the film about Dr. Jonas Salk at the Sherwood Auditorium a couple Fridays ago. He would have been 100 October 28th, is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely, 100 years.
Yeah, so gosh, what a great night that was. And you, of course, emceed and moderated the panel, which included his son, Dr. Peter Salk, who's a La Jolla resident, right?
Yes, he is. He's a medical researcher. He had worked with his father for 13 years. He worked on HIV and autoimmune, so mm-hmm. he has a pretty long history himself.
Yeah, wonderful. So, you've got it right on top of that microphone. There we go.
Okay.
So, anyway, let's talk about you a little bit to let our listeners know, because you haven't been in San Diego all that long, but tell us about your journalism career. Went to college Northeastern in Boston, right?
Mm-hmm.
Born and raised where?
Born and raised on the coast of Maine, Bar Harbor, Maine. College in Boston. Worked in Connecticut. Was in South Florida for 5 years, and then I moved to California in 1985 and was at the Orange County Register for 25 years.
Wow.
Came a San Diegan in April 2010.
Wow. Did they find you or did you find them? How'd that work?
The Register?
No, the UT.
The editor of the Register, Jeff Light, who was at the Register, came down here to become editor.
There was an exodus down here, Joe.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I came down to work with Jeff.
Wow, that's great. Well, you OC Register, has had quite a good reputation as well. So you're focusing mostly on science, technology, and defense now. Has that been your bailiwick for most of your years at OC Register?
Yeah. Okay. I've been a science writer for almost 30 years now.
Oh, wow.
What did you major in college?
Journalism at Northeastern. Okay. I was a night fellow at MIT in 2000. I took a year off to study science.
Huh.
Did you have an interest in science when in college as an undergrad, or was that later?
Oh, I'm a child of Apollo. I was really into the space program. But the writing about science came when I moved to California. I covered UC Irvine. They were growing and exploding. And I just got interested in their science faculty, and it took off.
Mm. Outstanding.
That's a great school.
Yeah, it is a great school.
Well, now the UT carried your wonderful extensive article in the Sunday edition of October 26th, which you saw and read also, right, Richard?
I've got it with me.
Yes.
I stole my mom's newspaper since I don't subscribe.
Yeah, front page.
I do online.
I get it online too. But I happen to have a copy because they were handing them out at the Sherwood Auditorium. Mm-hmm. And that was a UT-sponsored event, which was very impressive. Now, you said are they all films? You did 10 events this year, and you're going to do 24 next year. These are public forum type events?
Yeah, they're primarily meant for subscribers, to build subscriber base. And we have done 10 this year, including the big one on the Navy called Navy Town.
Mm-hmm.
We just did one on Iraq. But next year, we're going to more than double that. We're finding that these are really good ways to engage with readers and to build brand and connect with the community.
So it'll definitely include a panel discussion, I assume, but will it always be a film or maybe something, or a lecture or a variety of things?
Or discussion. I think we're going to have one in January with the renowned cardiologist Eric Topol about mm-hmm. where medicine is going.
Mm-hmm. Outstanding. So now this piece here for the UT, how much time did you spend up at the Salk Institute to get a lot of this researched?
Off and on, 6 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah, we're in the laboratories a lot. We interviewed a lot of the scientists who had known Jonas Salk and also people who didn't to kind of figure out how the Institute affects the way they think. So the story was not just about Jonas Salk, but about the Salk Institute, and including how it's designed. It's an architectural masterpiece.
Louis Kahn, right?
Oh, Louis Kahn.
Yeah.
So the design of it is something that really contributes to the way people think. It has really, it doesn't have walls inside. So one lab goes to another, it's meant to encourage people to talk across disciplines. That works really well.
Hmm.
So his whole design is meant to bring out
collaboration,
aspiration.
Yeah. Have you seen Robert Redford's piece on the Salk called Cathedrals of Culture?
I've seen part of it, and we tried to get a hold of him when he was here. He did that because he felt that the building had a soul.
Right. I was there.
It was
fascinating.
Mm-hmm. It really was.
It was amazing. And then Al Gore showed up, so it even got better.
It's amazing that the building was even constructed. When Jonas Salk pushed that in the 1960s, they didn't have the money. Mm-hmm. You know, he was getting most of his money from the March of Dimes. Mm. And after the vaccine came out, donations to the March of Dimes just plummeted.
Right.
And so he lost his main financial backer, and it took years to rebuild it.
His producer said after they get that whole, because that's just one part of, I think, a 6 or 7-piece series,
maybe 8-piece
series. So they said we can get it back at some point after they've finished their whole cycle of commercializing it.
Yeah.
It'd be nice to do an event centered around that piece. It was amazing. It really was.
Yeah. Now, the film that you guys featured, A Shot to Save the World, I think it had another title too. It was made by some producers out of Pittsburgh, but ultimately aired on the Smithsonian Channel.
Mm-hmm.
That was a wonderful piece. I mean, I'm going to try and see if we can get that aired on locally here on one of the stations as well. Usually City TV is pretty good about things like that, especially with importance of...
Should combine it with the Redford piece when that's available, because that's only, each segment's only 30 minutes, Joe, because that's, one piece of a larger series.
Well, that's quite possible, But...
I wasn't sure how to introduce that to the public because it's actually a really disturbing film. It brings up a lot of things that happen. The sight of children in iron lungs and in braces. The fact that a lot of people in America were shunned aside if they had polio. If you had polio, your name was in the newspaper. You know, it was that kind of time.
Oh, yeah. It was like the witch hunts, right?
I was born in 58, so I remember at a very early age getting the vaccine.
Yeah.
But I remember kids.
Well,
you
got to see this film, Richard, because
leg braces, and we had a scare in our city when I was 4 or 5 years old, where they had to close a public swimming pool because they thought a kid who hadn't been vaccinated had been in the public swimming pool.
Well, was it transmitted? I mean, FDR, they think he dove into that pond or something and may have contracted. Do you get it through that?
Yes, it's passed that way. It's passed through, bodily fluids.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you brought that up because that was the big thing about polio, particularly during the first half of the last century. There were smallpox and other diseases actually killed more people, mm-hmm. but there was an outsized fear of polio because people didn't understand it. They were not clear for decades on how it spread, on why it affected children more than it affected adults, why it tended to happen during the summer rather than other times of year.
Mm-hmm.
So the very unpredictable nature led a lot of people to stop hugging, kissing, to exchanging money even at times. And as I said, trains would go around some towns where there had been outbreaks. So its impact on society was extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look at the Spanish flu in 1919 or so, and wiped out about 50 million people worldwide or some crazy number like that.
Yeah.
But I guess when you get maimed or physically disabled, it's even more scary for people, But how are we doing on time there, Justin? Anyway, I did ask a question at the panel about the origins of polio, and I think Peter Salk did address it, but he said it goes back to 3000 BC.
It does. It's old, but it's, the origins don't seem well understood to me. Peter did talk about that, but mm-hmm. it wasn't clear how it came through time.
Right.
I thought what was interesting was they talked about it taking hold in America, perhaps because the country was becoming a more clean country.
Too antiseptic.
Yeah, we were using more soaps and various things.
You triggered the thought. Remember he mentioned the breast milk had the antibodies, but maybe after World War II, this is my theory, maybe more women went to baby formulas or the baby formula companies, the one that starts with a G, I won't mention it, but maybe more women went to that and there was less breastfeeding and perhaps that was a factor. I don't know. That'd be an interesting question. I don't know. But any theories on that? Have you heard any?
I don't have a theory. It's just so confusing. There's no clear path
mm-hmm.
that explains what happened. The only thing that was clear was the fear associated with it.
Robert Redford had a minor case when he was a child.
You know,
he disclosed that at the film showing.
So did Neil Young. There's a lot of prominent people today, if you go back in time. Mm-hmm. By the time this airs, Itzhak Perlman will have played at Salk. He's giving a benefit concert. He was a polio. He is a polio survivor.
Sure.
So a lot of famous people.
Huh. Does he have any residual effects, Richard, that we know of? Or?
Redford said no, he doesn't think so.
Anyway, we'll get more into this right after new sports and weather. And we'll come right back with Gary Robbins of the UT San Diego. Hang on. All right, we are back with... Are we back? We are back, Justin. We're back with It's Your Money and Your Life, the award-winning show, and now time for Richard to thank our sponsors.
Thank you to our sponsors. Our major sponsor, UBS, Michael Caronta and Drew Freitas, couldn't do it without you. Also, they, of course, were the major sponsor of Art San Diego. We had a lot of fun down there, didn't we, Joe?
Absolutely.
Also, right across the street, Prospect Street in downtown La Jolla, from UBS is Regions Bank, the best business bank in San Diego. Sean Puckett and Steve Sefton. Jason Kruger with Signature Analytics, the best CFO company here in San Diego, our favorite CPAs on the planet. Paul Polito and Don Epic, CPA, Polito Epic CPAs up in Vista. Geiger Law Office, Brenda Geiger, focusing on estate planning and asset protection. Berkeley Research Group, Carl Sheeler, best business valuation firm I've ever met, helping business owners understand the risks that drive the values of their businesses and how to decrease the risks and increase the value of the business. Speaking of making money, Joel Grushkin with Cost Segregation Initiatives, helping real estate owners improve their cash flow. And of course, Servant Leadership Institute, servantleadershipinstitute.com, have a big event coming up on March 9th and 10th at the Coronado Marriott, where the first time ever in history, the big three of leadership will appear on the same stage at the same time. That is Dr. Ken Blanchard, John Maxwell, and Stephen M. R. Covey. Servant Leadership Institute. com. Joe, how can our listeners find out about our amazing roster of sponsors?
Well, all I have to do is get on iymoney.com and get your cursor over to sponsors. There's a drop-down menu, and you can find all their information right there. And Richard's worked with all of them for many, many years with great success.
On a weekly basis, at the end of the year, it always seems. We always have things in the hopper this time of the year.
Yes, and I also have to thank Courtney.
Courtney.
Now she has all of our medallions up on the website from the past 2 years of our success with the Press Club Awards. So thank you, Courtney.
Plus, every show we've ever done. By alphabetical listing of the guests. Yeah, so they're easy to find.
Yeah, there's also a drop. If you go to guest lists or along the top page menu, there you'll find them all there, everywhere from Irwin Jacobs and Malin Burnham, now to Gary Robbins, Bill Lanowitz, Bill Lirak, George Takei.
It's a who's who.
Don Rickles. We'll talk to anybody.
Dickie Smothers.
Billie Jean King. I mean, you got it. Anyway, and now Gary Robbins. And of course, back to Gary Robbins, who's the science.
You'll be under the R's, Gary, just
okay.
So you know.
who's been in journalism his whole life and did
well, not since his whole life, Joe.
Well, his whole adult life.
He had an adolescent life.
His whole adult
life. There you go.
17.
17. Okay, 17. Most of it.
To me, that's what life begins at 17, doesn't it? I don't know.
His Girl Friday. I saw His Girl Friday on TV with my dad, and I knew right at that moment.
Really?
Cool.
Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell.
Cary Grant, yeah.
Oh, there you go. I know other people have had life-changing moments from films. I know Bill Lyrak's dad took him to see the Gregory Peck film, To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, it's
a
great film.
It changed his life. But anyway, there was some controversy. We'll get back into polio for a moment. But as far as locating the Salk Institute, there was a little bit of a battle going on. Pittsburgh wanted him because he did a lot of his work there. Palo Alto wanted it there. Some people talked him into doing it. Was Leo Szilard a central figure in convincing him?
Szilard was a figure. He was not the central figure. The central figure was Roger Revelle.
Uh-huh.
Szilard had talked to him about creating a biomedical institute. Szilard was a physicist, but he had a very deep interest in biology, and he had this idea in mind for a long time, and they had met in New York and talked about it. But it was really Revelle who noticed that Pittsburgh was not moving fast enough. Stanford didn't seem that interested, and Revelle knew that he could get public land in La Jolla. And so he put a note kind of indirectly to Salk and said, you need to come take a look. He did, and he was soon convinced to come, but they did fight over the land. Revelle wanted him to move to a certain part of that bluff, and Salk wanted a different part. They fought about it, but they worked it out.
And it, is it true that the city donated that land, correct?
Yeah, you exactly right. Yeah. Went before the voters.
Wow.
And is it also true that the mayor of San Diego at the time was a survivor of polio or had close family? I forget. I read this somewhere.
Charles Dale or who? Which one?
Yeah, he had polio.
He had polio. That's right.
And he was instrumental in getting this through. They ended up with 27 acres there. Could you imagine buying those 27 acres today?
Couldn't happen today. Well, Revelle, my gosh, what a giant, actually, physically and literally. I mean, he was 6'4".
Yeah.
But, you
what
know,
a visionary.
Here's a guy at Scripps Oceanography, gets the vision to now found a university in addition to getting the Salk Institute here. So one helped the other, I would think, right?
In addition to helping bring the land together for General Atomics.
There you go.
So you put UC together with Scripps and with Salk and with General Atomics. You now have a mesa that has 26,000 workers on it.
Yes.
It's amazing.
It's a city, has its own zip code, right?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's always in the one, two, or three top largest employers of the county, right? I mean,
it is. San Diego, UC San Diego is the third largest employer in the county.
Yeah. So anyway, back to polio. So, we know it was around 3000 BC where it first showed up. And then the epidemic, when did it really start in the U.S.? In the 40s, in the 30s?
No, it started before that. It showed up in the late 1890s a little bit, and then at the turn of the century it began to outbreaks began to occur in the United States in places like New York, other parts of the country. I think you mentioned you're from Illinois.
Yeah.
It was in Illinois and among other places. Then it became more prevalent as the virus spread among populations.
Yeah. And of course this film, you're right, I mean the scenes where the dozens of kids in the iron lungs. I mean, I've heard of iron lungs. I've never had seen them, demonstrated in that number. It was really sad. I mean, to see these children suffering like that. So, but now you said March of Dimes ran into an issue where the funding ran out. Why would it go? Because they thought it was cured, and then the whole operation came to a halt. Or
exactly.
What?
In 1955, they announced that the Salk vaccine was safe and effective. And after that, the amount of donations to the March of Dimes began to go down and down and down.
Mm.
Now Salk was counting on money from March of Dimes to build what would become the Salk Institute, and so it took a lot of time for him to pull the money together. In fact, he had to make sure to recruit a lot of really famous people so people would know this was going to be a real thing. There were financial problems that slowed the construction and development of the Salk for a long time.
Well, apparently he didn't patent the polio. He gave it away, the vaccine, he gave it away. Do you think maybe on second thoughts he may have found a way to at least make some kind of revenue from it to help build an institute, maybe in retrospect? Or
no, I don't think that Jonas Salk was that kind of person. He was an altruist. His entire life was about serving other people. When he was asked that question about patents, he said, well, could you patent the sun? Mm-hmm. No, you couldn't. This was for the people. He was a humanist. He cared not only about the human body, but about human behavior, man's relationship to man. So he was a man that had two lives. He had a second act. It wasn't just about the polio. He made the discovery when he was 40. The vaccine came out when he was 40, but he devoted the remaining 40 years of his life to public service as well. He worked on the HIV vaccine and multiple sclerosis. So I don't think that he would have tried to use patent money to create the institute.
So this guy was like a combination Einstein, Mother Teresa or something. He obviously bringing in the human element endeared him to many. He became pretty much a rock star of the science and medicine world, right?
In his time, he was the single most famous scientist in America and among the best known people on the planet. Ron Evans, one of their scientists, was saying that there was a time when his name was as well known as Churchill and Gandhi.
I had the distinct honor of meeting him about 3 years before his passing.
Yeah,
and just a great individual. But it always bothered me that other people attempted to sort of, I don't want to say besmirch his name, but say that he didn't necessarily contribute as much to finding that cure as popular culture suggests he did. Because I think to Jonas, it didn't really matter who necessarily got the credit because he was very collaborative and was only interested in the final result, the best result for humanity.
That's absolutely true. What he did was, he did a couple of things. he helped confirm how many different types of strains of polio there were. You couldn't create a vaccine mm-hmm. without first doing that. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of the grunt work that other scientists didn't want to do, and he took the hard positions. He sought a killed version of the virus where others wanted to do a live virus. Mm-hmm. He was going against scientific dogma. He had a personality where he didn't fight back publicly. So people like Albert Sabin, who were promoting the live virus, really belittled Jonas Salk, mm-hmm. and he wouldn't fight back because he believed that negativity generated negativity. Right. He was satisfied with the work. And in the end, that's what mattered.
Mm-hmm. Well, he certainly has quite a legacy and quite a following, and we'll get more into that when we take our right after our break. We'll come right back with Gary Robbins and more about Dr. Jonas Salk right after this.
AM 760 KFMB.
All right, we are back in the home stretch with Gary Robbins and talking about Dr. Jonas Salk here. And he did become a rock star. A lot of celebrities sought him out, didn't they, Gary?
Brad Pitt showed up at Ron Evans' office one morning roughly 10 years ago.
And unannounced? He didn't even call down?
Totally unannounced. He happened to be in town on something else, and it was almost like his secretary was going to faint away. She was so shocked by that. That was actually a common thing. A lot of people dropped by. The singer Paul Simon showed up, and Salk showed him around and brought him to Evans' office. It was because a lot of people saw this man as having relieved so much misery, they just wanted to meet him. He was charismatic, although, ironically, he was a really, really dull speaker.
Huh.
You know, his sons will tell you that.
Mm-hmm. How about if Brad Pitt plays him in a movie? Maybe he's researching. But he just wanted to see where he worked, basically.
To see his offices in his lab.
Are they still there?
Ron Evans, another researcher, Ron Evans, now has the office space of Dr. Salk.
Have you taken the tour, Joe?
No.
You got to. It's incredible.
I mean, I've been up on the campus and I've had
no, you gotta take the tour
up there. But
it's amazing.
So have they left a lot of his things intact or some of his space, or they've just pretty much, they must have some kind of a memorial tribute or something.
There are tributes throughout the Salk Institute, but really it's now Ron Evans' place. And Evans has become a major American scientist. A lot of people thought he might actually win the Nobel Prize this year. His most recent paper talked about modified vitamin D and its potential, and I want to emphasize the word potential, as a treatment for pancreatic cancer. Right now, there are no good treatments for pancreatic cancer. This is something that worked in rodents, and they're now trying to find out whether modified vitamin D, not regular vitamin D, but a modified version might be something that would be useful.
That's one cancer that they really haven't made much progress on, huh?
No,
and,
no
progress. Unfortunately, really. That's the one Larry Himmel contracted and passed away from. So, yeah. And it's pretty virulent once you're diagnosed.
Very fast.
It's a matter of months.
Very fast.
Yeah, so it's unfortunate. Well, let's hope they make some progress here. Well, they must have a lot of Nobel laureates how big is that place as far as...
They have about 50 investigators. Roger Guillemin, who is a Nobel laureate, is still on the faculty. Roberto Del Bacco, who longtime resident of La Jolla, he was a Nobel laureate. Mm-hmm. He died not so long ago. Mm-hmm. They have, I think, four different people who scientists believe could win the Nobel. So people like Tony Hunter, Ron mm-hmm. Evans, Inder Verma. They have quite a stable of incredible researchers there. Mm-hmm. And they're doing a lot of expanded work right now in brain research. They're going to be getting a lot of money out of the BRAIN initiative that President Obama mm-hmm. announced a year ago in the spring. In fact, Terry Sanowski on the Salk faculty is one of the people who is helping the NIH determine where the money will go. Hmm. So Salk is collaborating with UC San Diego, people like Ralph Greenspan, on work like that. You're going to see a lot of news.
There's a lot of collaboration. Now, there's consortiums up there. The Sanford Burnham Consortium, the Salk people and the Sanford Burnham people and the UCSD people, they all kind of get together on certain projects. Is that how it works?
They absolutely do. And it's an interesting place. It has the largest concentration of life sciences in the United States outside of the MIT Harvard corridor.
Huh.
So there are six major institutions up there. Put them together, you can literally walk the 1.4 miles between Craig Venter's lab and the other ones on the far end at Sanford Burnham. You don't find that in other places.
Well, I say we're the UCSD in that area is the Harvard MIT of the West, and I think we've got a little better climate and a more beautiful
better view
part of the world. Yeah. I think I get more inspired looking out at the ocean than some basement on the East Coast, but maybe that's just me. I don't know. Well, now, getting back to the building itself, the structure, wasn't it designed to help people's creative powers and imagination? And
it was absolutely meant to do that, and they did it in a variety of ways. It was meant to be an aspirational kind of place. So they could only build so high there due to regulations in La Jolla. One of the floors had to be built below ground. And what Louis Kahn did was to make sure that they built so-called light wells, these big areas where light would come flooding down into the basements and flow into the basements so that you weren't kind of cordoned away in the dark where you didn't see the seasons and the sunlight. The other thing was, of course, the courtyard that separates the two buildings. That looks out onto the Pacific, and it's built in such a way as it leads you to think about nature and man rather than simply about science.
Well, it has a water path that runs from the parking lot, so to speak, that's to the east all the way to where it appears to drop off the horizon.
It looks like it goes off into infinity, right? I mean,
basically.
It's called the River of Life.
The River of Life.
And you have to be super careful because it's kind of that slot between the things. I've tripped over that so many times.
It's the River of Sprained Ankles.
Now, they can't fix anything so pedestrian there, Joe.
Now, I wonder if they've used, you know, we had Dr. Irwin Jacobs on this show a year ago or so, and you know, we talked about classical music and neuroscience and maybe how classical music helps improve imagination and creativity. And he said there are studies that prove that. Did they incorporate any of that at Sauk? I know they've done some concerts there, some benefit concerts and things.
They've done they had a forum just within, the last month where they talked about the intersection between neuroscience and architecture. I don't think that they understand it, but it's certainly one of those incredibly rich areas to look at.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you separate the mind from architecture? There's no way to do it. How do you separate the soul from architecture?
Well, lighting, you know, structure, all the senses obviously must affect us in some way. If we find out how to optimize that, and every little edge can help. And of course, Yitzhak Perlman's coming there for right?
You mentioned before this, you know, by the time this airs, Yitzhak Perlman will have played there. He's playing on Thursday. We're going to be talking to him tomorrow afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
This is a benefit concert just for the Salk. They're trying to raise money for the Biomedical Institute. Now, he's a polio survivor, as you know, and so he'll be coming to put on a performance.
That's great. Any other breakthroughs or areas that they're working on that we should know about? Because we're in
diabetes,
the home stretch here.
Cancer, diabetes, and heart disease. Cancer and heart disease kill more people than any diseases there are. When it comes, people should understand this is basic research. Most of it is not applied.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking at fundamentally how the body works. And they've been doing some real interesting work recently on heart disease and diabetes and metabolic syndromes, which are incredibly important.
Yeah, outstanding. And now his son, Paul, he's had two sons that are MDs, PhDs, right?
His sons are Peter, Jonathan, Daryl?
Right.
But I know two of the three.
I know Peter runs his Legacy Foundation, correct?
Yeah, he does. Peter lives in La Jolla, runs a foundation. Peter's 70 now. He feels it's very important to keep this legacy going.
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan lives up in Los Angeles. All three sons are or were doctors, and I believe the third son lives up in Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Are they working with the Salk directly on any discoveries or anything like that, or they mostly do other things?
They mostly do other things, but they're keeping the memory alive, and in a way, I think they do so in a powerful way because they're very generous about talking to the media. The most single important thing that anybody said to me during this research was something that Jonathan said. He invited me to the family home on Ellentown Road there in La Jolla. This is where Jonas Salk lived for almost 30 years. It's a weekend home for Jonathan. And I asked him about his father. And he said, you know, the thing that sticks in my mind is that my father would walk around that building every single day, and he would subconsciously put his arm out and run his fingers down the side of the building, because the building and the work there, done there meant so much to him. And that helped me understand Jonas Salk unlike anything else I heard.
Well, his whole body, life, soul was wrapped up in that whole project, and the world is all the better for it. So, Richard, do you have any final thoughts or anything?
What else is going on in science in San Diego? Oh my God, Richard!
Well, we got to invite him back. For, we got to invite him back for that.
Stem cells, right?
Stem cells, other brain. Big areas, wearable technology, and robotics. You're going to see a lot of news out of UC San Diego on robotics.
Yes, okay. Even Qualcomm's working on this stuff.
Oh yes, they're working on neuromorphics and making the chips like how our brains work.
Yes, so that's
I don't want
good.
A chip like how my brain works. But anyway. Either.
Well, we had UCSD Chancellor Pradeep Khosla on in June talking about the Brain Initiative, and we're going to have Dr. Ralph Greenspan on in January. Mm-hmm. So, but Gary, thank you so much for being
our
guest.
Yeah,
really appreciate it.
And we'll have to have you back again sometime. And then Professor Thad Kalsler, thank you. Richard Musil, you have a great week. Justin Howard, our sound engineer, thanks for making us sound great. And thanks to Craig Blanke, our con executive, and Dave Sniff, our programming genius here at KFMB. All the podcasts are at iymoney.com. You have a great week. We'll see you next time. Good night now.